Welcome everybody. This is the first, this is the 11th lecture in my course on Purification, Ethics and Karma in Early Buddhist Discourse. I hope you are able to see and hear me now. No sound. So I'm trying now again. Can you hear me now? Okay. Gosh, these technical things are playing around with me every time. So I clear the chat. Jan, you still can't hear me? I just keep saying something without any kind of deeper meaning to check. So Akinshana can hear me. Jan, can you hear me? Okay. And I think I start. So, welcome everybody. This is the 11th lecture in my course Purification, Ethics and Karma in Early Buddhist Discourse. And it is also the last session we are going to have in this semester. The blog on the internet will still be open until the end of July for us to keep discussing if there's anything to be discussed. After the 31st of July, your passwords will no longer be valid. Which means that at that point you will no longer be able to get onto the OLAT platform, where so far we have been showing the audios and videos and having the blog. But I gave a website, I think on the 8th or 9th lecture. My voice is very unclear. Not sure if I can do something about that. Is it better like this? Okay. Yeah, Jan, I think I just write a reply to Jan. So the plain audio lectures, together with the notes to the lectures, are available on another website. The link I gave, I think, in the 9th lecture, but I'll post it up on the blog this time again. And that will also be the website for you to keep in order to look for the enrollment for next year, which I think will start on the 1st of March. There's two ideas I have for next year's course, two small changes. One thing is that I'm thinking of having the course 4 hours earlier in the day. So instead of 6:15, it will be 2:15 of our Central European time. And the main reason for that is that I want to enable access to some of those interested from Asia, because for them this time of the day is in the middle of the night. And also I'm thinking of changing in so far as, you see, we have these 3 holidays every semester, so the course actually runs into 12 sessions. The first session is just an introductory into new students how to use the software, so there will always be these 11 lectures. And I thought of just ignoring all these holidays and just going through in one go, and then maybe stopping a little earlier. In that way, we would be stopping at some point towards the end of June already next year. These at present are all ideas, and I would just like to ask you to comment on this in the blog if you see any problem with these. And also, please tell me what I can do better next time. You see, this is just a pilot project, and this monk is doing this for the first time in his life. So and there are probably quite a number of things that I might not be doing in the way you would like me to do, or that might at least be doing better next time. And as the teacher's fee, give me criticism, give me feedback, so next time I can do things differently. Right. Last time, just briefly review what we did last time. In talking about the Kalama Sutta, I had pointed out that there's a four-step investigation of the Buddha presented in the Vimamsaka Sutta. There were several comments on this part of my presentation on the blog. One point I found very significant by Laura de Bernardi. Just regarding Kalama Sutta and similar teachings, it is always important to place a certain particular injunction into context. Like the example of the Kalama Sutta, this kind of chart of free inquiry, I think I call it, or it is generally so called, applies to a rather specific situation, to the realm of morality, and people who are asking for guidance in the realm of morality and who are very interested in that. And regarding this four-step investigation of the Buddha, Laura de Bernardi also made several comments. One was how one validates the wisdom of a teacher for oneself. That is not an easy task. I think that's quite true, but I think the significant point of the discourse is that, first of all, it invites us to make such a validation, to such an investigation, and I think this is rather significant. And this is really the point that intrigues me about this discourse. It's kind of saying no to this idea of the guru who is beyond being questioned. And this is an idea that has not only been prevalent in ancient India, but we can also find counterparts in some modern Buddhist traditions. And pointing back to this discourse, we could question that. Then still Laura de Bernardi, step two, the scrutiny of the attitude of the teacher. She mentions, involving how the teacher handles their own fame, is, I think, particularly relevant in this day and age of celebrity and narcissism. I also found this quite to the point, specifically this idea of narcissism, which then was taken up by other people also on the blog. This all pointing back to the problem of ego. Still another comment from her. That is about the personal verification, the last point. I found step four fascinating, she says. Confidence in a teacher is attendant on personal realization. That is, you have put their teachings to the test of your own practice, the onus being so powerfully on personal responsibility. Yeah, this also resonates very much with the way I understand the discourse, that the other parts are a preparation for this personal verification. And the whole point of the discourse is to put responsibility into our own hands, not expect that Guruji does it all for us and tells us what to do and we give up our responsibility to someone else, but that even though a teacher may not be fully awakened or may be fully awakened or whatever he or she is, that we get this injunction to question, to investigate. Investigate the teacher, and if he or she is appears reliable as much as we can assess that, then to place confidence or faith with that particular purpose of using that opportunity for personal verification. There's one more comment, this time by Linda Grace. It's a little longer. She says, what I find to be important in looking at a teacher, and also at my own defilements and wholesome qualities, could be looked at in a simpler way even, in terms of the degree of self there is. I don't mean self in terms of being a functional individual, but in terms of how a self gets taken up and created and identified with, which can be in various aspects and even extremely subtle ways. How well a teacher, or any of us, responds to and handles feedback from others, that seems crucial. This also, I feel, very nicely sums up the gist of the discourse. Yeah, now I'm going to go through the two discourses that we looked at rather briefly. We have rather two long discourses to look at today. And there was also not much discussion on the blog regarding these discourses. So the first one was the discourse to Gamini. You might remember that a person who tells the Buddha, you please make people reappear in heaven. And the Buddha then, in reply, he points out, as I have here on our blackboard, or whiteboard maybe I should call it, that rebirth in hell or heaven depends on one's own conduct, not on prayers by others. And we get these two very illustrative similes. Just as a stone thrown in water will sink to the bottom, even if people may be praying, rise up, rise up. Or just as oil thrown in water will rise to the surface, even others may be praying, go down, go down. It's just a natural law. And the other discourse we had, Madhyama Agama number 18, excuse me, that was that Siha, a follower of the Jains who comes to visit the Buddha, and the Buddha then reinterprets certain concepts. Like he's being called somebody who denies action, teaches inaction or non-action, and he says, yes, in a way I'm teaching non-action, and in a way I teach action. And he does that with the several terms, annihilationism, asceticism. Yeah, there were also no discussion on these. And in the end, I presented, because the Siya Sutta in the Pali version is also on the issue of meat eating in the Vinaya version. So I briefly presented what I believe are the significant passages on this topic, that a person who slaughters an animal in order to offer this food to the Buddha or his monastic disciples incurs demerit on 5 occasions. And another discourse which presents us with a threefold type of purity in regard to the precepts of abstaining from killing. And according to this discourse, full purity in this respect is not only when we refrain ourselves, but also when we encourage and applause others in abstaining from killing. And my argument was that this does no longer leave us the leeway of saying, well, as long as I don't kill, then meat eating is fine, I can just buy it, it doesn't matter, I do not have to look at the consequences. Which is also a little bit would be in contrast to the emphasis we get throughout the discourses and in meditation to look at things from the perspective of their causes and conditions. This is, I think, an important aspect that in many things we need to consider according to Buddhism. Well, this was my relatively quick review. If there are any questions, I just clear the chat, then please feel free to ask them now. And otherwise, I will go into the two rather long discourses that we are going to look at today. As for M17, Manfred says, there is the idea of transference of merit, very prominent in Asia, which is somewhat contradictory. Let me just check what you might be meaning. Do we have a transference of merit there? Maybe you mean that these similes contradict the notion of transfer of merit. Do I understand you correctly? Could you say something, Manfred? Because I'm not sure what exactly you are pointing at. Okay, Manfred, I said that you made this comment as for M17, there is the idea of transfer of merit very prominent in Asia, which is somewhat contradictory. And I just had a quick look at MA17. I don't see a direct connection, but I was wondering if perhaps you mean that these similes are contradicting the notion of a transfer of merit. Could that be the point you're making? Yeah. I have tried to research the idea of transference of merit in another discourse in relation to the Satchika Sutta in an article published maybe a year or two ago. My own impression is that there are a few instances in the discourses which already seem to support this notion, although one could get the impression that these are maybe slightly later, but it's a little difficult to be completely sure about it. And, I mean, tradition would argue that the transference of merit is not really happening as such, in the sense that it is really being transferred, but it's more like, I think the traditional argumentation is that if, like, say, somebody does a good deed, and then he says, may those spirits, pretas, whatever they are, may they rejoice in this, and then they rejoice in it, and in that way they share the merit. So on that argument would then not stand in full contradiction with the notion that we get here, that prayer will not make the stone float and the oil go down. But I think the point of Madhyama Agama 17 is really about somebody going to heaven and to hell, and for that prayer is not sufficient. I'm not sure if it intends to completely dismiss the power of prayer at all. Because, I mean, we could argue that somebody who, say, if I wish you well, I pray, may you be well, and that is an act of loving kindness, and it's good for me, and who knows, if my loving kindness is strong enough, it might even affect you. Just to make a case for the other side. How did they call that in English? To play the devil's advocate or something? There's something coming from Akinshana, I think. Maybe I continue already, and whenever it comes, we can always interrupt. So what we have here is Madhyama Agama 19, the discourse to the Nigantas. This is the parallel to the Devadaha Sutta. And I start reading. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying among the Sakyans in Devadaha. There, the Blessed One told the monks, The Nigantas hold this view and declare, whatever one experiences is caused by what was done in the past. If past karma is eradicated through asceticism and no new karma is created, then all karma comes to cease. All karma having ceased, the cessation of dukkha is attained. The cessation of dukkha being attained, the end of dukkha is attained. There's a small difference here to the Pali version, which has an intermediate step according to which the destruction of dukkha then leads to the destruction of feelings. And with the destruction of feelings, all dukkha will be overcome. Let me just return to the question by Akinshana before I continue with the discourse. So she says, there's a sutta preached to the citizen of a specific town about the safe way regarding another life after death or no life after death. But the Buddha says you should observe sila, etc., because it is safe. Present benefit as well as next life is good, no doubts. Yeah, maybe you mean the Apanaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Yeah, thank you for sharing. So I think I continue with the parallel to the Devadatta Sutta. I have abbreviated the next part. The Buddha just approaches them, and this is a standard procedure in the discourses. First of all, ask if they indeed hold this view. And when they say, yes, yes, this is our view, this is what we believe, he asks them, do you personally have clear knowledge that I existed in the past, or I did not exist in the past? Excuse me. I did evil in the past, or I did not do evil in the past. This much of the dukkha that I created has already been exhausted, or this much of the dukkha that I created has not yet been exhausted. Or when this has been exhausted, when its exhaustion is attained, then by practicing I will realize in this life the eradication of all unwholesome states and the attainment of manifold wholesome states. They replied, no, Gotama. So whereas we have these four points here, the Madhyama Agama version, in the Majjhima Nikaya version we have five. The query is, if they know that they existed in the past, if they know that they did evil in the past, if they know what type of evil they did in the past, if they know how much dukkha they have already exhausted through their practice, and if they know how to overcome unwholesome things here and now. So before I continue, I have another look. There's another question. Juliana says, we are still with the prayer. I think that prayers, metta, etc. could well be effective, but not in terms of leading to heaven or to hell exactly. From the perspective of the passage in Madhyama Agama 17, if these mental actions such as prayers and metta can indeed influence somebody else's mental state and thereby present karma, perhaps they can have an influence in keeping one in hell or heaven for a little longer or shorter once she's already there. Okay. Good point. Thank you for sharing. Well, the metta is not going to keep the others longer in hell, no? I hope not. I think I continue with the, yeah, it's very lively today, I appreciate that. This is actually the way I had been hoping it would be all the time, but unfortunately we have this problem that this audio thing is not working so well, one of the many technical problems we have, and so the discussion is getting always a little slow down because I'm the only one allowed to speak and you will have to type, no? Very unfair actually. But nobody so far complained. You should be typing, we will talk. Well, I did my typing homework before, no? Okay, let me continue instead of making stupid jokes. There's another question by Akinshana. I have a question about a sutta on is there a next life or not? I'm not sure about what sutta you're talking. If it's not a sutta we are discussing here now, Then I would rather leave that question for another time. Yeah? Okay, I continue reading. So the Buddha recapitulates the above and then concludes that their proposal is not justified, and then he comes up with a simile to illustrate that. Nigantas, suppose that a man's body has been wounded by a poisoned arrow, and because of being wounded by this poisoned arrow, extreme pain arises. Then, out of sympathy and concern about the wound, his kinsmen and relatives call a surgeon to pull out the arrow for his benefit and well-being. The surgeon comes and with a sharp knife cuts the wound open, and while the wound is being cut open, extreme pain arises again. Having cut the wound open, the surgeon probes for the metal arrowhead, and while he is probing for the arrowhead, extreme pain arises again. Having probed and found the arrowhead, he pulls it out, and while he's pulling it out, extreme pain arises again. Having pulled out the arrowhead, he dresses and bandages the wound, and while he's bandaging it, extreme pain arises again. After the arrowhead has been pulled out, that man regains his vigor and feels well. Without any damage to his faculties, he recovers and is just as he was before. Nigantas, that man, personally having clear knowledge, thinks, formerly I was wounded by a poison arrow, etc. You get the whole description. I recovered and was just as I had been before. Comment. I think the point of this simile is just to say that it is reasonable to go through painful experiences if that is part of a verifiable cure that will lead to health eventually, that will lead to freedom from pain. I continue with the discourse. In the same way, Nigantas, if you personally had clear knowledge that I existed in the past, then, Nigantas, you could claim, whatever one experiences is caused by what was done in the past, the end, etc., the end of dukkha is attained. Again, I ask the Nigantas, if the Nigantas engage in strong striving and strong asceticism, will at that time strong pace arise in the Nigantas? They reply, yes, Gotama. Then he asks them if they engage in middle striving or in weak striving, and they have to always admit that the corresponding type of pain will arise. And so the Buddha concludes, it should be known that the Nigantas are simply producing their own pain in the present life. So he says pretty much what the argument is simply, when you strive a lot, you have a lot of pain. If you strive little, you have little pain. So the pain you have is not because you're expiating karmic fruits of the past, but simply because you're striving a lot or striving very little. Bye, Hedwig. Now, it comes another set of arguments. I should note that we have a variation in sequence before I continue. In the Majjhima Nikaya, this argument about the strong and weak striving comes at a different junction. It comes later. And instead, at this point, the Majjhima Nikaya turns to the claim of the giant leaders that he is omniscient. I think we come to that in the Majjhima Agama later. This is one of those standard differences to which you must be getting used by now, that we get relatively similar teachings, but somehow they've exchanged places in the variant versions, in the parallel versions, I'm sorry. So now we get into a different argument. The first of the points made here is, I also asked the Nigantas, if there is an action whose result is to be experienced as happiness, can that action, through striving and through asceticism, be turned into having dukkha as its result? And they reply, no, Gotama. And then he asks them the opposite, that means to be experienced as dukkha, or can it be turned into happiness? And they also have to deny it. The second argument, Nigantas, if there's an action whose result is to be experienced in this lifetime, can that action, through striving and through asceticism, be turned into having its result in a later life? They reply, no, Gotama. And then again, we get the reverse case, a later life to be experienced now. Third argument, Nigantas, if there's an action whose result has not yet matured, can that action, through striving and through asceticism, be turned into having its result matured? They replied, no, Gotama. And we get again the reverse case. And the Buddha concludes, therefore, Nigantas, your effort is in vain. Your striving is empty and futile. Majjhima Nikaya, we have two more arguments here. I've put them all down with the correspondence in the Madhyama Agama behind, as you can see. So the notion of shifting present retribution to a later life and other way around is the first, in Madhyama Agama the second. Convert pleasant to painful, change mature to immature, and then after much retribution to become little, change much to little and little to much, and exchange retribution for no retribution at all, and the reverse. Last is a little puzzling. Anybody should wish to exchange no retribution for retribution, but let it be. Akinchana, I'm not fully sure if these messages are meant to me. Here you say it is different from Kalama Sutra. There you say no, it is the same sutra, the same question. And I believe it's all about the next life or not. I mean, even if it's Kalama Sutta, I would rather like to put it aside for the time being, because... Yeah... Maybe if you type out in detail the question you have on a Word file, and I go through this one, the Madhyama Agama 19, and then we can have a look at your question. Would that be okay? You can't say no, no? So I continue. Then those Nigantas told me, now we get the claim to omniscience we had earlier in the Pali version. Gotama, we have a venerable teacher named Nigantanataputta who proclaims thus, Nigantas, if you created evil karma in the past, then that karma can be completely extinguished by means of this asceticism. And if you now restrain your body, speech and mind, then through this restraint you will not create any further evil karma. I asked those Nigantas, do you believe in your venerable teacher, the Nigantanataputta, without having any doubts? And they reply, Gotama, we believe in our venerable teacher, the Nigantanataputta, without having any doubts. Again, I said to those Nigantas, there are five things which may have a twofold result in the present life. They are belief, liking, oral tradition, memory, and well-considered view. This is a pretty much a standard teaching we also get in other discourses. We even get it in the Kalama Sutta that we were discussing earlier, a little more extended version, where we did not have any of this in the Madhyama Agama version, you might remember. And this is basically saying that there are certain sources of knowledge, like there is an oral transmission, something that has been remembered, there is a certain opinion or view we might have after well considering it, there is something we like, or there is something we just have strong faith in, a belief, and these in themselves are not sufficient sources for knowledge. They should not be relied on exclusively. This is not an entire, a complete dismissal of these, but just saying that this is a source of knowledge that is limited in itself and needs to be counterbalanced by other sources of knowledge and by investigation. So before I continue, I just have a look to Manfred says, alter retribution to become little seems to be possible as the simile with a cup of salt showed. Yeah, definitely. Nice cross connection. Thank you. Monks, if the Nigantas speak thus, then they incur a fivefold censure according to the Dharma and can be reproached. So the difference here with the Pali version that instead speaks of a 10 tenfold reproach, ten legitimate theses, dasa sadhameka vadanu vada. And as we are going to see, both texts present five. And then, after these five, the Pali version continues by saying, even in the absence of these five, each, it goes to each, they can be reproached. But I think the count of ten comes from that, but I think that's a logical mistake, because you have five reasons, and the absence of these five can only count as a single reason, not as five additional reasons. So I think the Madhyama Agama version, by speaking of a fivefold Sanjaya, makes more sense, and it does not have the absence. But let me go first through these five, then maybe that becomes a little clearer. If all the pleasure and pain that these beings now experience is caused by actions done in the past, then the Nigantas must have done evil in the past. Why? Because that will be the reason why the Nigantas now experience extreme pain. This is the first ground on which the Nigantas can be reproached. Second, if all the pleasure and pain that beings experience is caused by the company they kept, that means the kind of birth they were living in a past life, or this is basically the idea we get. I continue, then the Nigantas must have kept evil company in the past. Why? Because that would be why the Nigantas now experience extreme pain. This is the second ground on which the Nigantas can be reproached. Again, if all the pleasure and pain that beings experience is caused by destiny, then the Nigantas must have had an evil destiny in the past. Why? Because that would be why the Nigantas now experience extreme pain. This is the third ground on which the Nigantas can be reproached. Again, if all the pleasure and pain that beings experience is caused by views, then the Nigantas must have held evil views in the past. Why? Because that will be why the Nigantas now experience extreme pain. And this is the fourth ground. And the fifth, again, if all the pleasure and pain that beings experience is caused and created by a supreme god, then in the past the Nigantas must have been created by an evil supreme god. Why? Because that will be why the Nigantas now experience extreme pain. This is the fifth ground on which the Nigantas can be reproached. We have these five grounds in the Majjhima Nikaya version as well. As you can see immediately, we have a different sequence, and we also have slightly different terminology. Former deeds, created God and company is the same also, only it differs in the placing. Instead of In the idea of destiny, we have the type of life form, and we have a practice instead of view. I think the number four, the idea means what one has been before, what type of being one has been before, and the fifth one means what one does in the present, either the type of view one holds or the type of practice one does. Then comes a passage which is not found in the Majjhima Nikaya. The Dharma which I came to know by myself and realized by myself, which I have proclaimed to you, cannot be refuted, cannot be defiled, cannot be prevailed over by any renunciant, Brahmin, God, Mara, Brahma, or anyone else in the world. Why? If a monk abandons unwholesome actions and practices wholesome bodily actions, if he abandons unwholesome verbal and mental actions and practices wholesome verbal and mental actions, then in regard to future dukkha due to present unwholesome actions, he personally knows there will be no such future dukkha for me. In accordance with the Dharma, he attains happiness and will not discard it. Aspiring to eliminate a particular cause of dukkha, he may practice with that aspiration, or he may practice equanimity. A comment, I'm abbreviating this. In the original, this is a little tricky, and I'm just trying to go through the main ideas of the passage. I continue, once the dukkha has been eliminated, unwholesome states cease and wholesome states arise, and he no longer needs to eliminate dukkha. Why? Because monks, his original purpose has been achieved. It is not the case that he might need to eliminate dukkha again. This is again pointing on this, what we already had earlier, this point that there is, if there is a reason to go through pain, then this is okay, but it's not just experiencing pain for its own sake, which is recommended. And then we get a simile. And monks, it is just as a fletcher may use a template to straighten an arrow. But once the arrow has been straightened, he has no further use for the template. Why? Because that person's original purpose has been achieved. It is not the case that he might need to use the template again. So we get actually two similes, one of a man who has fallen in love and one of the straightening an arrow. And in the Majjhima Nikaya, we have these two in the opposite sequence. Oh, I should have mentioned earlier also. No, that comes later, I'm sorry. Yeah. This course is a little long. It's difficult for me to remember all the points I need to make. We get to the second simile in the Madhyama Agama. Monks, suppose that a certain man loves a woman, is attached to her, and has high regard for her. But the woman instead gets talking with someone else, exchanges greetings with him, and they go off and spend the night together. Would, because of that, physical and mental dukkha, vexation, and extreme grief and sorrow arise in that man? And the monks replied, yes indeed, blessed one. It's a small difference in the Majjhima Nikaya. They laugh together, they exchange greeting, but they do not go out to spend the night together, so it's a little less grievous in the Pali version. The Buddha says, monks, suppose that man thinks like this, I love that woman and have high regard for her. But that woman instead got talking with another man, exchanged greeting with him, and they went off to spend the night together. Because of my dukkha and sadness, shouldn't I now rather cut off my love and attachment for that woman? Then that man, because of his own dukkha and sadness, cuts off his love and attachment for that woman. If that woman, as before, gets talking with someone else, exchanges greetings with him, and they go off to spend the night together, would again, because of that, physical and mental dukkha, vexation, extreme grief and sorrow arise in him? The monks replied, no, blessed one. In the same way, a monk, once the dukkha has been eliminated, he no longer needs to eliminate the dukkha. Why? Because his original purpose has been achieved, he need not again eliminate the dukkha. I have abbreviated this part again. Then he has this further thought. Whatever the cause of this dukkha that was to be eliminated, I have eliminated it. Yet, with regard to desire, it is not eliminated. At this point in the Majjhima Nikaya version, we get a full account of the gradual path. The Madhyama Agama is more succinct, it just goes into a main aspects that are relevant to the present discussion. In order to eliminate that desire, he dwells alone in seclusion, resorting to a secluded place, to the base of a tree, to an empty, quiet place, a mountain top, a cave, a place in the open air, a heap of straw, or he goes into a forest or to a cemetery. He spreads his sitting mat, sits down cross-legged with upright body and upright intention, and sets up mindfulness before him. He abandons covetousness, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, he abandons doubt. Having abandoned these five hindrances, which are imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, having abandoned desire, abandoned evil and unwholesome states, etc., up to, he dwells having attained the fourth absorption. When he has attained concentration this way, his mind being purified without blemish, free of vexations, malleable, well-established, having attained imperturbability, he directs his mind to the realization of the higher knowledge of the destruction of the influxes. Yeah, the Majjhima Nikaya version again differs. It has the recollection of past lives and the divine eye before it comes to the destruction of the influxes. I'm coming to you, Juliana, in a minute. Let me just go through up to this part. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows this is the origin of dukkha. He knows this is the cessation of dukkha. He knows, as it really is, this is the path to the cessation of dukkha. And then we get the same for the influxes. He knows, as it really is, these are the influxes. This is the origin of the influxes, the asavas. This is the cessation of the influxes, and this is the path to the cessation of the influxes. Knowing thus, seeing thus, his mind is liberated from the influx of sensual desire, from the influx of existence, and from the influx of ignorance. Being liberated, he knows he is liberated. He understands as it really is. Birth is ended. The holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will be not be another existence. So let me stop shortly and see. There's a comment here by Juliana. I see a small problem. How come could one be blamed, reproached because of point 5 in the Madhyama Agama version? If it's the God's fault, would one be responsible for this because it's an instance of wrong belief view in itself, so one is held responsible for it? I think the point is not so much that one is being blamed, but just the thing, the reproach comes because the proposal made results in the consequence of the proposal that the Creator God is responsible for everything, made by somebody who's living in a lot of pain, then he can be, it's not that he should be blamed for what the God has done, good that you pointed out, but rather that the belief in a Creator God then results in having to believe in an evil Creator God, and I'm not aware of any religion who does that. Normally the Creator God is always held to be something good. But how could a good Creator God be responsible for my suffering? Why did he create me with so much suffering? I think this is the type of reproach we get here. Yeah? Thank you for asking. So, he is liberated. And now, we get this good actually that you asked it at this point, because we get the same argument in the opposite way. So if the theory I were correct that all the pleasure and pain that beings now experience is caused by deeds in the past, then the Tathagata must have done sublime actions in the past. This whole passage is making a little bit. It's making a little fun. Like, I mean, if that theory is good, holds true, then I must have done nice things, or I must have had a nice Creator God, I must have kept nice company. It's just a way of humorously showing that this type of reasoning does not work for the case of inflicting suffering on oneself, but it works very well for the Buddha. Then the Tathagata must have done sublime actions in the past. I continue. And because of that, the Tathagata now experiences a noble happiness that is free of influxes. Quiescent and calm, he has attained happiness and awakening. This is the first praise gained by the Tathagata. And then he gets 4 more for the company they have kept, for destiny, for holding views, and for being created by a supreme God. Then the Madhyama Agama continues by enumerating 5 causes and conditions owing to which sorrow and dukkha arises in the mind. What are the 5? This part is without a counterpart in the Pali version. And we are told, entanglement in sexual desire, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt. These are the 5 causes and conditions owing to which sorrow and dukkha arise in the mind. And there are 5 causes and conditions owing to which sorrow and dukkha disappear from the mind. What are the 5? If one is entangled in sexual desire, and because of entanglement in sexual desire, sorrow and dukkha have arisen in the mind, then on abandoning entanglement in sexual desire, the sorrow and dukkha will cease. Owing to entanglement in sexual desire, sorrow and dukkha have arisen in the mind, but on attaining the goal in this lifetime, there is freedom from vexation and affliction, constantly present and unchanging, as is known to the noble ones and seen by the noble ones. In the same way, if one is entangled in hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, if one is entangled in doubt. At this point, we get a reference to the Noble Eightfold Path and the conclusion to the discourse. So this rather long and complex discourse, I just summarize the main points. So first we get a criticism of ascetic practices with the simile of the poison arrow. The simile illustrates that it is meaningful to undergo suffering if that is part of a verifiable cure. Then we get in themselves insufficient sources of knowledge, which I already explained a little bit. Belief liking all tradition, memory, and well-considered view. Then we get a criticism of attributing present experience entirely to either karma, that is a karmic determinism, or to the company one kept, one's former type of life form or destiny, excuse me, one's view or practice, and a supreme god. And based on overcoming what is unwholesome, one strives to abandon a particular source of dukkha. Once that has been achieved, no more need to strive. Like a fletcher who has strained on an arrow, or like a man in love whose love is over. And then in the Madhyama Agama version we get the five hindrances as a source of dukkha. So that is what I have to present from this discourse. There is time for questions. Just a semantic one from Linda Galash. Is austerity to be equated with asceticism, as the Buddha negated strongly the practice of austerities as a way to enlightenment? Yes. Yes. So, Madhyama Agama 20, the discourse to Paratalya. Parallel this time is in the Samyutta Nikaya. Thus have I heard, at one time the Buddha, who was wandering among the Koryans, together with a great company of monks, arrived at the village of Uttara and stayed in a rosewood grove north of Uttara. So the Madhyama Agama version continues by reporting that our Patalia, the protagonist of this discourse, has heard that the recluse Gotama has come, and he knows about the Buddha's good reputation for being awakened, and thereon he decides to visit the Buddha and approaches the rosewood grove. From afar, Patalya, the village headman, saw the Blessed One amongst the trees of the grove, dignified and beautiful, like the moon amidst the stars, with radiant aura, shining like a golden mountain, endowed with handsome appearance and majestic dignity, with sense faculties calm, free of obstruction, accomplished and disciplined, with his mind calm and quiet. Yeah, this we don't get this description in the Pali version. Yeah, I wrote it here. The Samyukta Nikaya version directly sets in with the conversation. So this whole introductory narration, and particularly this description of the Buddha with his radiant aura, is not found in the Pali version. So our Patalya approaches the Buddha, exchange greetings, and then he says, I've heard this, the recluse Gotama knows magic. At this point, I have abbreviated the Chinese, which makes a mistake actually, and it's a logical inner mistake. And the first question, as in the Pali, should just be "He knows magic," and it is only later on that then he draws the, we will see, wrong conclusion that because the Gotama knows magic, he must be a magician. And in the Pali version, this becomes very clear, but in the Chinese version, somehow, by mistake, this statement, already the first statement is, Gotama knows magic and he is a magician. And then the whole rest of the story fails to make sense. This is just interesting how sometimes, through some error in transmission, something is filled up, I assume, by simply recitation, memorizing, not really thinking about it, which patently fails to make sense. So in order not to confuse you with this error, I just have put dot 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 there. So the question he should be asking is just, the recluse Gotama knows magic. Gotama, I read, continue with the discourse, those who say the recluse Gotama knows magic, are they not misrepresenting the recluse Gotama, and do they speak what is true? And the Buddha replies, Headman, those who say the recluse Gotama knows magic, they are not misrepresenting the recluse Gotama, they speak what is true. And now Patali is surprised. Although what those recluse and Brahmins were saying is true, yet I did not believe them when they said, the recluse Gotama knows magic, he is a magician. At this point, he is a magician comes in his right place. And we continue with the discourse. The Blessed One said, Headman, if one knows magic, does one therefore become a magician? Patalia says, indeed, Blessed One, indeed. Now he gets an admonition which is not found in the Pali version. The Blessed One said, Headman, do not make a mistake and misrepresent me. If you misrepresent me, then you harm yourself. You will be criticized, you commit an offense, and you will be condemned by the noble ones for having perpetrated a major fault. Why? Because the truth is not in accordance with what you say. As I mentioned, this whole part is not in the Pali version. Now we get an illustration. Headman, have you heard that the Koliyans have soldiers? And Pattaya replied, yes, I heard it. What do you think, Headman? Why do the Koliyans employ soldiers? Patalia replied, to kill bandits, Gotama. For this reason, the Koliyans employ soldiers. What do you think, Headman? Are the Koliyan soldiers virtuous or without virtue? And Patalia replies, Gotama, if in this world there are those who lack virtue, the Koliyan soldiers are certainly among them. Why? These Koliyan soldiers break all the precepts and behave in evil ways. The Buddha asked further, Headman, you see it thus and know it thus, and I do not question it. But suppose that someone else were to ask you, Hetman Patalya, you know that the Korean soldiers break all the precepts and do only evil. Therefore, Hetman, you too break all the precepts and do only evil. If someone were to speak like this, would he be speaking the truth? Patalya replied, no, Gotama. Why? The Korean soldiers break all the precepts and do only evil, but I keep all the precepts and do no evil. The Buddha asked further, Hetman, you know that the Koliyan soldiers break all the precepts and do only evil, but you do not for this reason become one who breaks the precept and does only evil. Why then should it not be the case that the Tathagata knows magic but is not himself a magician? How is that? I know magic, I know magicians, I know the result of doing magic, and I know the elimination of magic. Headman, I also know killing of living beings. I know killers of living beings, I know the result of killing living beings, and I know the elimination of killing living beings. And the same for taking what is not given and speaking falsehood. In the Samyutta Nikaya version, we get not only magic, killing, taking what is not given, and falsehood, but we get the whole 10 pathways of action, up all the way up to wrong view. Somehow it seems to me that the Chinese version is a little bit more fitting the case. Anyway. Then we get another passage here, which is not found in the Samyutta Nikaya version. It's a threat that he's going to be reborn in hell for this. So the Buddha says, if someone says, the recluse Gotama knows magic, he's a magician, and if he does not give up saying that, we get the full statement. Then when his life ends, he shall, as quickly as one might bend or stretch out one's arm, be reborn in hell. On hearing this, Pataliya, the village headman, was greatly afraid, trembling with his body hair standing on end. He immediately got up from his seat, paid homage at the Buddha's feet with his head, and kneeling down with palms placed together in respect, said to the Blessed One, I repent, Gotama. I confess, Worldly One. I was like a fool, like an ignorant person, like an unstable person, like an unwholesome person. And the Madhyama Agama version continues with the standard description we get of how the Buddha would accept the confession of somebody who has done something wrong. This entire episode is not found in the Pali version, and I strongly suspect this to be a later edition. Continue. So now we come to a different issue. Our Pataliya, our headman, is now asking something quite different. The first issue has been settled about knowing magic and the Buddha being mistakenly believed to be a magician, therefore. So Pataliya tells the Buddha, Gotama, there's one type of recluse and Brahmins who hold this view and declare, if someone kills living beings, they will get the entire result in this lifetime. And because of that, sorrow and dukkha will arise. If someone takes what is not given or speaks falsehood, they will get the entire result in this lifetime. Because of that, sorrow and dukkha will arise. Recluse Gotama, what do you think of this? And the Blessed One said, Headman, I shall now ask you something. Answer according to your understanding. What do you think, Headman? And he gives a simile, a description now. In a village, there may be a man who has garlands on his head and various perfumes applied to his body. Singing, musing, and dancing are performed for his entertainment, and he is presented with courtesans to enjoy himself like a king. Then someone asks, what has this man done? Someone replies, this man killed an enemy of the king, and the king, being delighted, bestowed rewards on him. And now we get a counterexample. Headman, one may also see that a criminal is arrested by the king. His hands are bound behind him, and with a drum being beaten and the sentence proclaimed, he is taken out through the southern gate of the town, seated beneath a tall signpost, beheaded, and his head is put on display. Then someone asks, what crime has this man committed, and that he is executed by the king? Someone replies, this man wrongly killed an innocent person from the king's household. For this reason, the king ordered this punishment. So the Buddha concludes these two examples. Headman, if a recluse or Brahmin holds this view and makes this proclamation, if someone kills living beings, they will get the entire result in this lifetime, and because of that, sorrow and dukkha will arise. Are they saying what is true, or are they saying what is false? And Pataliya replied, it is false, he said, Gotama. If they say what is false, would you have faith in them? Pataliya replied, no, I would not have faith, Gotama. And the Blessed One praised him. Very good, very good. Now we get two other examples. I'm going to go to them a little more briefly. I think I'm a little bit afraid of boring you by reading it out all in detail. So we get somebody who is enjoying himself, and then we get the question, what has he done? And someone replies, in another country this man took what was not given. And so the king was pleased and gave him rewards. But then we get a criminal arrested and being executed, and this man also stole, but he took something from the king's country. And we get another time the story of somebody with his garlands on his head, enjoying himself like a king. And on being asked, what has this man done? Someone replies, this man is a singer, able to entertain and amuse. He delighted the king with false speech, and the king, being delighted, bestowed rewards on him. And then again we get the criminal arrested and executed. And when it's been asked why he's being executed, then someone informs this person, "This man lied in testimony before the king. With lies, he tried to deceive the king. For this reason, the king ordered his punishment." And now Patalia is very happy and impressed by this teaching. He says, "Marvelous. What Gautama said is wonderful, with good similes and good proof." This concludes the second part of the discourse about this teaching that karmic retribution has to be visible right in the present. Now we get another part of the discourse. This is the third part. Oh, I should mention that Patalia getting up from his seat and expressing his delight at the teaching is also not mentioned in the Pali version. There the Buddha continues straight away with his exposition. So Patalia here tells the Gautama that he has built a hall in his village and for recluses and Brahmins to come and stay, and he gives them whatever he can. He looks after them, and so now these four different teachers, they come to this hall. And then he reports their view. This is here. And I think you might recognize this view. This is the standard wrong view. There's no offering, no sacrifice, no incantation, no wholesome or unwholesome actions, no result of wholesome or unwholesome actions. There is neither this world nor another world. There are no father and mother. There are no true persons in the world who are headed for supreme attainment, who are well gone and well directed, who have themselves known and realized this world and the other world, who have themselves directly realized and accomplished it and dwell therein. Yeah, we discussed this view already. And now the second teacher has the opposite view. The Madhyama Agama stands alone in qualifying this as having right view. The second teacher had right view. Opposing the view and knowledge of the first teacher, he held this view and made this proclamation: there is offering, there is sacrifice, etc. Then we get a third view. One who acts or instructs another to act. One who destroys or instructs another to destroy. One who tortures or instructs another to torture, causing distress, vexation, sadness, beating of breasts, despair, weeping and bewilderment. One who kills living beings, takes what is not given, engages in sexual misconduct, speaks falsehood, drinks intoxicating liquor, breaks through walls to open storehouses, intrudes into others' territory, destroys villages and towns, wipes out cities and countries. One who acts in this way is not doing any evil. And we get this very stark image. Again, if by using an iron wheel as sharp as a razor, one were in a single day to cut into parts and kill all the living beings on this earth, slicing them into pieces and turning them all into a single heap of flesh, this does not amount to evil action, and the evil action will not have results. If one were to go along the southern bank of the Ganges, killing, destroying and torturing, and to come back along the northern bank of the Ganges, making offerings, undertaking sacrifices and chanting incantations, then there is no offense and no merit because of this. There are no results of offense or merit because of this. Making offerings, taming oneself, guarding oneself, restraining oneself, esteeming, benefiting, generosity, speaking pleasantly, doing good, sharing profit, one does not earn merit because of this. There are no results of merit because of this. And the fourth teacher then has, as the Madhyama Agama version towards it, has the right view, and he opposes this whole. There's a comment by M. I don't know who M is, but Indian kings must have been very happy about the third view. Perhaps. So our Patalia is doubtful. Having heard this, Gautama, I have come to doubt of these recluses and Brahmins, who is speaking the truth and who is speaking falsehood. Here we come to the passage that I already mentioned when we discuss Kalama Sutta. The Blessed One tells him, Headman, do not let doubt arise in you. Why not? Owing to doubt, hesitation arises. As I told you in the Pali version, we instead get the acknowledgement, just as in the Kalama Sutta, that the Buddha says, yes, yes, you have good reasons to doubt. This is a doubtful issue, actually. So the Buddha continues, Headman, you yourself do not have pure knowledge about whether there is a next life or no next life. Also, Headman, you do not have pure knowledge regarding which way of action is evil and which way of action is wholesome. Yeah, we discussed this difference, so I don't need to go back into this. Headman, there's a Dharma meditation called abandoning. Through this meditation, you may attain right mindfulness. You may attain one-pointedness of mind. In this way, you may cut off your doubt in this lifetime and achieve progress. And so Patalia gets up and asks to be taught this Dharma meditation. Yeah, in the Pali version, again, we don't have this intermezzo. The Buddha straight away continues to tell our visitor here what the type of practice he should undertake. So I continue with that. Headman, a learned noble disciple, refrains from killing, abandons taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, false speech, and so on, up to wrong view. During the daytime, he instructs people to farm and cultivate the fields. This whole passage is not found in the Pali version. And when evening comes, he rests from this and goes indoors to meditate. When the night is over, at dawn, he thinks, I have refrained from killing and have abandoned killing. I have abandoned taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, false speech, etc. He examines himself. I have abandoned the 10 unwholesome causes of action and have been mindful of the 10 wholesome causes of action. And when he sees these 10 unwholesome causes of action abundant within himself and is mindful of the 10 wholesome causes of action, joy arises in him. Joy having arisen, rapture arises. Rapture having arisen, the body becomes calm. The body having become calm, he experiences happiness with the body. The body having experienced happiness, he attains one-pointedness of mind. It's a very nice passage, brings us back to a point that Manfred made in one of the blogs earlier, that in the discourses we often also get emphasis on the positive aspects, not only on the what one has done wrong. This person has abstained from different things, and he's not only thinking of the what he has not done, but also what he has done, and I'm free of these, and joy arises, and he gets concentrated. Oh, M must be Manfred, in fact. Now I realize, yeah. Headman, a learned noble disciple who has attained one-pointedness of mind, imbues his mind with loving-kindness, and dwells mentally pervading one direction, likewise the second, third, and the fourth direction, and also the four intermediate directions, above and below, all around, everywhere. With a mind imbued with loving-kindness, free from fetters and resentment, without ill will or quarrel, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. And then he reflects, there are recluse and Brahmins who hold this view and make this proclamation, there is no offering, etc. If those recluse and Brahmins are speaking the truth, then I have offended against neither the fearful nor the fearless in the world. The Samyutta Nikaya version differs here a little bit. It also mentions that the person knows that this type of conduct leads to rebirth in heaven, which we don't get here. But I continue with the Madhyama Agama. I have always had compassion and empathy for the entire world. Towards all beings, my mind has been free of contention, untainted and delighted. Now I have attained the Dharma of the unsurpassable person, attained progress and a happy abiding. This is called the Dharma meditation of abandoning. Don't ask me why it's called abandoning, I don't know. What these recluses and Brahmins say may be correct or incorrect, but whether it is correct or incorrect, I have attained inner tranquility of mind. Headman, this is the Dharma meditation called abandoning. Through this meditation, you may attain right mindfulness. You may attain one-pointedness of mind. In this way, you may cut off your doubt in this lifetime and achieve progress. The Madhyama Agama version then works through the same pattern for the other views, and in each case it mentions another Brahma Vihara. In the case of the Pali version, we get all Brahma Viharas together each time, and that seems to me to make more sense. As this Dharma was being taught, the spotless and immaculate Dharma eye in regard to all phenomena arose in Patalia, the village headman. Patalia, the village headman, saw the Dharma, attained the Dharma, realized the bright and pure Dharma. He cut off doubt and went beyond perplexity. He became independent of other teachers. He would never again follow others, and he became free of hesitation. Having been established in the attainment of the fruit, he attained fearlessness in the Dharma taught by the Blessed One. This whole passage is not there. We do not get a report of his stream entry in the Pali version. We only get him taking refuge, which we also have here now, and I read that. He rose from his seat, paid homage with his head at the feet of the Buddha, and said, "Blessed One, I now go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the community of monks. May the Blessed One accept me as a lay follower. From this day forth, until life ends, I go to him for refuge." This is what the Buddha said, and having heard the Buddha's words, the village headman and the monks were delighted and remembered them well. So this was also a rather long discourse. Thank you for being so patient with me. And the main points that this discourse conveys to us, I think, are that the fruition of karma is not necessarily something that is immediately visible in the present moment. We have these beautiful examples of somebody who kills, and in one case, because this pleases the king, he gets all kind of gratification, and in another case, because he kills somebody that the king did not want to have killed, he gets punished and his head cut off. And the other point, I think, is that living a moral life, life of ethics, and practicing the Brahma Viharas gives an inner confidence, an inner strength that does not makes one independent, unshaken, unaffected by various views that others may propose, which one might not be able to verify for oneself. Yeah, that was what I had to say on this discourse. We still have a little bit of time, and I wanted to say something in general on oral transmission, but I shortly wait if there's any question in regard to this discourse. Yes, a concluding point to this examination that you have been joining me during the past 11 sessions. Just a look back. I mean, there was a lot of content we discussed. I'm very happy about that. We had very nice discussions on the blog. But there was also this, I think, this growing awareness of what it means to be dealing with texts that are the final result of an oral transmission. I am going to through the first part here a little bit quickly so as to leave time for questions. In one of the past lectures, Linda Galesh had already asked about this repetition. Sometimes we get like the same thing said with two, three different words. And this is a basic pattern in oral transmitted literature. I just have here a few examples how the same basic meaning, just take the first, being old, is said in several different words, and these words are arranged according to syllable length. So the shorter words will come first, and the longer will come later. So, I mean, let me just stay with the first example. If I just say in passing, and I met so-and-so, and you know, he was quite old, and blah, 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 and I continue, and afterwards, later, I want to remember that, I might forget that detail that this person was old. But if I get this first in the poem, you know, I met so-and-so, and he was Jinno, Vundo, Mahalako, Andagato, Vayo, Anupato. This is such a long chunk. And also it has this rhythmic quality to it, that the chances that I do not forget this detail, that this person is old, are much higher. And also every time somebody is old, I can use that same standard phrase, that same jinno vundo mahallako adnagato vayo annupato. This is something as a reciter I'm already used to. So it's very easy to integrate that in the recitation. Maybe the first time we might imagine it's much more work to remember five words than one, but after some time getting used to this, it's actually helpful. And you already know once you have recited jinno, if you try memorizing, then the mind just automatically continues with vundo, mahallako and all the rest. And in the meantime, basically the mind can already relax a little bit and keep a lookout for what's coming next. It's very helpful in recitation. I'm not going to go through this in detail because I do not want to take up too much of your time. I had here another example of a very long chunk where you get subunits. But I just wanted to reply to that point that we briefly discussed by Linda Gallage in a former lecture a little bit more in detail still. What I have now is another aspect that is also very common in oral transmitted literature and very, very common in the Pali or in the early Buddhist discourse, and that is the use of pericope descriptions. A description of how somebody approaches someone, how somebody comes and gives greetings and exchange respects and etc. is always given the same form. The interesting thing is that sometimes we get slight variations. So, for example, we have here two examples of exactly the same meeting, the same discourse. I'm giving below the references where this happens and the Pali, but I'm just going to stay with the English now. So in both cases, this is the end of a meal offering by Prince Bodhi. And in one place, in the Majjhima Nikaya, we get a recurrent reference to somebody who is taking a low seat to sit down and listen to that, whatever the Buddha has to say after the meal. Now if you look here, we have when the Blessed One had eaten and had removed his hands from the bowl, Prince Bodhi took a low seat and sat down on one side. Exactly the same discourse, exactly the same passage in the Vinaya, we get when the Blessed One had eaten and removed his hands from the bowl, Prince Bodhi sat down on one side. We do not get the Anyacharan Nichang Asanam Gahetva there, the description of him taking a lower seat. You may say, well, this is not really such a big issue, but sometimes the variations can be more pronounced. This is all, you see, I forgot to properly introduce what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to show you now that there are also variations between Pali discourses. Not only between Pali discourses, Theravada on the one side, and on the other side maybe the Chinese, or sometimes we have something in Sanskrit or Tibetan, but I'm just working between Pali. And obviously there's very, very little material because we do not get much doubling. But even in that little material, we can find these differences. And I just find it important for us to be aware that these differences are part and parcel of this type of literature that we are dealing with, as we find them even in the Pali canon. So I continue with my example. This is Vasakaro is a minister of King Ajatasattu, and he's being sent to visit the Buddha and ask a question. And we have this passage, it's a very famous passage in quite a number of different versions. The first version here is from the Digha Nikaya. And we get a whole long story. Vasakaro, he's getting the order to go to the Buddha, so he assented to the order given to him by Ajatasattu Vediputta, the king of Magadha, got the stage carriages ready and mounted them, left Rajgarh by state carriage and went towards Mount Valchapeak. After going as far as the ground was passable for carriages, he descended from the carriage and approached the Blessed One on foot. Now we get the same passage in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's much shorter. Vasakaro ascended to the order given to him by Ajatasattu Vidhiputta, the king of Magadha, and approached the Blessed One. The whole description about getting into the carriage, getting down, etc., not found. Now we have another very famous passage. This is when Mara, the evil one, approaches the Buddha and asks him to relinquish his life force, to not continue living. And we have one version here. This is from the Digha Nikaya and from the Udana. This is very long. Not long after Venerable Ananda had left, Mara, the evil one, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he stood on one side. Standing on one side, Mara, the evil one, said this to the Blessed One. Now the same situation in the Samyutta Nikaya, we get this. Not long after Venerable Ananda had left, Mara, the evil one, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he said this. And here we get the Anguttara version. Not long after Venerable Ananda had left, Mara, the evil one, said this to the Blessed One. You see, it's getting shorter and shorter. You may say this is not so striking still, because this is all irrelevant, by the side kind of narration, and we know it's anyway implicit in the other versions. Now here I have one case where we have the same discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya and the Sutta Nipata. And at the end, the person who has received the teaching, he says, I go for refuge to Venerable Gotama, to the Dharma, and to the community of monks. May Venerable Gotama remember me as a lay follower who from today on has gone for refuge for life. So he takes refuge. Now the same person in the Samyutta Nikaya, we get this. I go for refuge to Venerable Gotama, to the Dharma, and to the community of monks. May I receive the going forth in the presence of Venerable Gotama and the full admission. And the Venerable Bharadvaja became one of the Arahats. So we get a whole different conclusion here. Instead of being a lay person, a lay follower, I'm sorry, who goes for refuge, he asks the going forth, he becomes a monk and eventually becomes an Arahant. And I think this gives us a clear hint that this variations we find between the Pali version. This is not just a problem with those Chinese versions. We don't. Let's just stick with the Pali canon. This is what I sometimes get from some Theravada friends. And this is not really the issue. Actually, the problems of proper transmission of oral literature are even evident on a close inspection of the Pali discourses only. Now, what is the significance of such comparison? And I think one thing, I briefly touched on that in an earlier discourse, in an earlier session we had, is that comparative study gives us a very clear-cut methodological approach. People can come up with all kind of ideas of what the early Buddhist teachings are about, and then just argue that whatever does not fit their ideas and conceptions is something that must have been put into the discourses later. And there is no end to the fancy views that you might develop in this way. But that is not methodological, and that is not convincing. Instead, we have this clear-cut method that we can use by comparing parallel versions. And as we have here the case in the Pali version, as we had just the case in the Chinese and Pali version, we compared. In one he gets stream entry, in the other one he does not get stream entry. There is a difference there. And both cannot be original. So then we can try to find other reasons to argue why we think this one is original, why we think that one is not original. Those reasons may be convincing, they may be not, but we have something we are basing ourselves on. We have a clear-cut difference there. These are parallel versions, and there's a clear-cut difference. And this is something that I think is really important, because I find, reading sometimes, that the awareness of the differences between the Pali Nikayas and the Chinese Agamas is in some circles leading to a free yielding hypothesis on pretty much anything that does not fit my idea. Oh, this must be a later product. And I think that just is not very convincing. And another point I think which is also important is that the fact that we have variations confirms that we are dealing with a genuine oral transmission. So by looking at parallel versions, we get actually a very strong stance on saying that those things which are similar between them must resort back to early Buddhism. The continuous variations we find even in small details and sequential matters make it quite clear that the parallelity that we find cannot be just a product of later stratification, later adjustment. This is a genuine oral transmission that we are dealing with. And this in turn also helps us to have a historical perspective on what is early Buddhism, what is later. This helps us to see what is different in Abhidharma, in the commentaries. There's one point I should briefly touch on because Linda Grace had asked that in one of the blogs, just the idea of path and fruit, for example. In the commentaries, we get this idea, we get this influenced by the Abhidharmic perspective on single mind moments. Path is one mind moment, fruit is another mind moment. So it's just two mind moments, tak tak, on the brink of stream entry. But in the suttas, what we get is descriptions that clearly show that the notion of path and fruit was something more extended. We have a description in the Dakinavibhanga Sutta and its parallels, where those who are on the path are mentioned as recipients of gifts. And the commentary then goes into an argument that these must be just at the moment of receiving their food or whatever gift they get, they must just have been practicing vipassana, and just at that moment they get the path and fruit. But I think this is rather contrived. And we can clearly see that path and fruit in the early discourses stand for an extended length period of time. This is not now to get into sutta fundamentalism and say all the commentaries in Abhidharma is wrong, this is just to be discarded, but just to see the difference and see these are two different but they could be complementary perspectives if we understand them properly. Yeah, I'm over my time again. So I think I have to leave any questions you might have for the blog. I hope that this last of our sessions was, in spite of being two very long discourses, not too boring and tiring for you. And yeah, I feel for myself being forced to be clear on what I have to present and also being enriched through the discussion, particularly on the blog. I have learned quite a lot for myself, so I look forward on continuing to learn from you next year. There's a comment by Juliana regarding momentariness theory influence descriptions of path and fruit, for example, of stream entry. The notion of time and space conceptuality wouldn't seem to be of relevance in such experiences. So it seems a bit contradictory idea anyway. Yeah, I wasn't wanting to dismiss that idea. That was just a question Linda Grace had asked. And I thought it fitted in into that concluding survey that I wanted to make. Okay, now I do stop, and I wish you well, and I look forward to see you and hopefully many others next year when we continue.